No more running down the road.
Whoa, wait. What the fuck are you doing?
Dancing to a different drum.
We fucking talked about this.
Can you hear what's going
on? You promised. Last time you fucking promised you wouldn't do this again.
What? You really believed me when I said I wasn't going to do Michael McDonald again?
God damn it.
What a fool believes.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, welcome to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as always, novelist slash screenwriter slash lieutenant in Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Yes.
Hello.
And it's a very special episode tonight.
It is a very special episode.
We're recording from the Casa della Worm.
The Casa della Worm, which is the creepiest thing anyone has ever called any place. And it makes me think of spring break and disease.
It's not as creepy as your converted garage sex dungeon.
That's true. I have no follow-up. That's just true.
Yeah, I mentioned that, and you're like, you're really not the first person to call it that.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. Everybody seems to be obsessed with the idea of me turning in my garage into a sex dungeon.
It might be the trapeze you have hanging from the roof.
It might be.
Could be the blow-up dolls, the pile of blow-up dolls.
Well, I don't know. I don't think they're multi-use objects. I think it's kind of a one-and-done situation. I don't want to wash that. Anyway, if you would like to hear more musings such as these, definitely check us out on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, we are continuing, we are running down the wrong road, or perhaps the very right road, as we continue Buddy Cop July here on Junk Food Cinema. And we're ending the month with a couple of films that I think oddly has a lot in common.
Oh, they're spiritual cousins.
They really are. And, you know, to look at them initially, you might not think so, but we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, we need to talk about this week's film, which I'm really excited to, because this is not only one of my favorite buddy cop movies. This is like one of my favorite movies to rewatch. This is a film that is so much fun, has so much energy, and is so well put together on so many levels, and a lot of them very unexpected. 1986. Billy Crystal, Gregory Hines, Running Scared.
We're looking for some new career challenges.
Yeah, something with a future. Show me another career they let you shoot people.
Give us your money.
You're mugging us?
I don't believe it.
You better believe it or you're dead.
Oh, come on, let us keep the driver's licenses and the snapshots.
And our badges.
Not the Paul Walker movie. This is the one about cops. This is the
one's about cops, too.
If you
actually watch all of the movie,
yeah,
instead of the good 90% of it and turn it off at that point, then yeah, it ends up being about cops.
You're talking about the Paul Walker Running Scared. Yes. Okay. Yeah. This movie you should watch 100% of because it is 100% good. It takes place in Chicago. You've got Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal as the buddy cops. And I mean, that term, I don't know, really ever fit any two people better than it fits Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines in this movie. They click so well. It's, you really do believe these guys have been partners for years.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, you know, it feels very much like the movie we're going to talk next week, Freebie and the Bean, where it's not so much a movie about plot, because the plot is actually really kind of simplistic, and the mystery is really readily solved, and all of the criminal elements just kind of fall in their lap. It's really about watching these two guys react to that. I mean, this movie takes off when two cops are just kind of hanging out and they see a guy who's just gotten out of prison going out on a drug deal. And they're like, oh, hey, look, it looks like a drug deal. And it turns out to be a drug deal. And then this very simple plot unfolds as we watch two guys hilariously stumble through it.
Yeah, these are very accidental heroes. These are guys that are just kind of there and just kind of stumble into everything. And handle everything with a great deal of panache, but sure as hell don't ever seem like they're out looking to make a case.
And unnecessary violence. That's another thing that these two movies have in common is they both have protagonists that are like really violent cops in an era when people are like, yeah, that's awesome. And watching it now, it's kind of like, dude, Billy Crystal, lay off. That's a violation of that man's... Yes, that man is a sleazebag, but Jesus Christ, you don't need to... Stop hitting him with the car door, Jesus.
I think that may be the first time anyone has ever said, Jesus, Billy Crystal, lay off. You're too tough
actually,
for this.
Having grown up in the 80s, no, that's not the first time anybody has suggested that Billy Crystal lay off. I think that's going to be my new, you know, thing for you. Is
what?
Just every time you start going off on something, just slow down, Billy Crystal. Lay off. Pull on the brakes there.
Look, Billy Crystal, you need to take it down a notch. But yeah, this movie was actually directed by Peter Hyams, who is one of those filmmakers I feel like never gets enough credit. He's got a lot of really great films okay, first of all, Outland. Which is the High Noon in Space starring Sean Connery. Absolutely fantastic film.
Badass movie.
Absolutely fantastic movie. He also directed a movie that I really love and I think is legitimately good. I don't know how everyone feels about it.
Oh, well, when you say is legitimately good, that usually means, oh, wow, people don't think it's very good.
That's fine. That movie is Stay Tuned. I don't know if you remember that one, John Ritter.
I remember Stay Tuned.
Yeah, Jeffrey Jones.
The magical remote control.
Yeah. Yeah, that I love that movie. Also, he directed probably the two most bearable Jean-Claude Van Damme movies in Time Cop and Sudden Death. So that's something. He also, interestingly enough, directed a movie called Busting in 1974, which is also a buddy cop movie with Elliot Gould and Robert Blake. And that is a direct connection to the movie we're going to talk about next week. And I will make that bridge at the end of the show. There's a real connection between those two movies. And this week's director, Peter Hyams, directed Busting as well.
Well, Peter Hyams is great.
Peter Hyams is great.
He's one of those guys that he doesn't get a lot of mainstream talk right now.
Mm-hmm.
But 15 years ago, when I first started reviewing, he was considered one of those great action directors that you know, all the various critics referred to.
Yeah.
And then he did The Musketeer. And that was just kind of like, oh,
it's unfortunate.
He used to be really awesome.
Well, it's unfortunate because like, he did 2010, which I know I'm in the minutest of minorities, but I actually prefer that to 2001. I like.
You are in the minutest.
I'm sorry. I like a story.
You think 2001 is boring.
Yeah, I like story.
Forever there, that will be a black mark on your soul. You are going to go to the gates of heaven, and they're going to be, you weren't that bad a guy, but you didn't do all that. Wait, you didn't like 2001? Gone.
No.
Bam. Purgatory for you. Not even hell. You don't even deserve hell. You're going to purgatory.
No, just like my movies to have a little bit of story, that's all. But I mean, so you get 2010, we've got Outland, also known as High Moon, and then The Star Chamber. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but The Star Chamber is actually really good, too. It's a very effective thriller with Michael Douglas. He's got a heck of a pedigree here, and what I like about what he does with Running Scared is he gives us a story in which you have two cops who are good at what they do, but don't want to do it anymore. And we usually, when you hear that, oh, you know, it's a cop and they're just done with it, they're burnt out, you're talking about older cops. You're talking about, like,
I'm getting too old for this shit.
Yeah, you're talking about Murtaugh. You're talking about Harry Callahan, four movies into that franchise. And with this movie, it's like, no, in fact, we're going to do this movie about two young cops who just decide that they would rather do something else. And so for the whole movie, you really see two guys who are just going to wrap up that last case before they you know, bugger off to South Beach and run a bar. And they're like, they're young guys. They're like in their early 30s, but they're just done. They're just like, I don't want to be a cop. I don't want to get shot at anymore. We're going to fly down to Florida. We've already bought this bar. And that's kind of what's interesting about the structure of this movie is that it is a cop movie, but it's sandwiched around this, like, just two guys in paradise kind of like montage that's like its own act of the movie.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this film is we get to that point where the cops have fucked up.
Yeah.
They get put on probation. Mm-hmm. Give me your badge and your gun. And this is the point in the movie where every other fucking cop is like, no, we're still going to stay on the job and we're going to, you know, investigate on our own.
They're going to go rogue.
And they're like, fuck it. We're going to fucking the Florida Keys. We're going to get drunk. We're going to fuck like 87 women.
Yeah.
In a montage. you know, and they're just like, fuck being cops. And they get to that point where after they fuck the 87 women, like they literally have a montage of them riding these bikes and switching women every time a car passes.
Yeah.
Because for some reason in the 80s, you could believe that Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines would get, you know.
Well, they both had those sexy, like, baby deer legs. I think that's really what turned women on. Like,
well, I get that. I get that.
This little matchstick
Gregory
legs.
Hines is like Corey Coleman of the 80s. Like, I get that. For the 12 of you out there that know what we're talking about.
I thought you were going to say the Corey Feldman of the 80s, and I was like, wait, no. That is the Corey Feldman.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Corey Feldman is the Corey Feldman of the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but...
Unless Corey Haim is the Corey Feldman of the 80s.
It's
I get
just
so confused.
Like, it's just completely absurd, but you're just like, oh, I guess we forgot about being a cop, you know, a cop movie.
Quickly. They forget very quickly about being cops.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, it's... their vacation's over, they're going back, and they're going to close out their time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're all of a sudden freaking out. And that's where the movie title comes from, is Running Scared.
That
they're trying to spend the last month of their careers not getting shot.
They're trying to avoid, and I think this is what's interesting. It's like this movie is aware, the characters in this movie are aware of cop movie tropes. So what you see, and the reason it's called Running Scared, is because you have two guys who are very aware of the tendency for police officers to get shot 2 days before retirement. Oh, irony, it's terrible. So the whole movie, once they get back from Florida, is them begrudgingly being like, we'll solve this last case, but we're not taking any risks. We're going to be as careful as humanly possible. So even though duty does call them back, they still approach it like, we're going to do as little heroics as possible because we just want to go to Florida. We just want to get to Florida and be able to live that life. So they're running away from, essentially, cop movie tropes. And I think that's what makes the movie interesting. I think that's why this one stands out. And what's fascinating, though, when you think about it, is that this movie was not written for Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines. And in fact...
Because why would it be?
Because why would it be? But, I mean, you just, again, you get thrown off by this, like, wait, so they're really young cops, but they want to retire. Apparently, the movie was originally written for Gene Hackman and Paul Newman to be made around the same time. So the story was originally going to be that they were older cops that were closer to retirement age that had decided to, we're just done. But when Peter Hyams was given the script, he asked MGM specifically to change it to younger cops. And again, if you think about it, it makes total sense this movie was written for older actors. I mean, that makes so much more sense why they would be like, oh, no, we're done.
And why they would go to Florida.
And why they would go to Florida.
Like, because when it happens in the movie, it's like, all right, they're in Florida.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I feel very much like that scene from Wayne's World where it's like, Delaware. We're
in Delaware.
Just like, it's Florida. And apparently women run around in pairs.
Yeah.
And are really easy in Florida. Like, that's everything you need to know about Florida that Running Scared has to teach you.
I feel like not a lot has changed in that state, except that it's kind of become Thunderdome. But other than that...
Well, the Thunderdome would be it. See, there's a cop movie we haven't seen.
Yeah.
They go out, you know, they get thrown off the force or get suspended. They go down to Florida and end up battling Florida Man. And
it's Florida Man.
Florida Man.
The hero who came from the Everglades.
It's, you know, it's just, you know, Florida Man did this and Florida Man did that. And they're on the search for Florida Man.
That's every headline. Every time I open, like, Florida Man did this, Florida Man did that. And it's like, oh, Florida Man, when will you stop being the worst?
Yeah. But there's a cop movie we haven't seen.
No, we haven't seen that
Let's
one.
Let's get Burt Reynolds out of retirement for that one.
So, but the upside to this change to younger actors, to younger characters, is that retirement becomes more of a character dilemma for younger cops. Like, to retire at their age takes a major or traumatic event to motivate the early split from their careers, whereas it also creates more tension as the film goes on. Because they're still so young, they're young enough to return to active duty if they change their minds before the credits roll. You know, if they were older cops or they're older characters, it'd be like, even if they made the decision, like let's say that this, you know, we change this movie, we go back to it being Gene Hackman and Paul Newman. One, it wouldn't be as dramatic when they quit because it'd be like, well, you're old, so you were going too soon. It was time. But then at the end of the movie, if they also decide, well, we're going to come back to the Force, you're going to be like, hooray, but you're probably only going to be here for like 6 more months and you're going to do it again. Yeah. So the change actually propels the tension of the movie a little bit, because it is pretty dramatic that they decide to quit so young. And you do believe that when they return to the Force, you're like, well, they'll probably stay cops for a while now because they're not 60. So I don't know. I think they've actually traded up, which is something I didn't think I would think about, trading from Gene Hackman and Paul Newman to Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
But there you have it. And yeah. So,
but you know, and the thing is in this era in particular, you know, on the heels of Cocoon, the old guys still being badasses mm-hmm. was a trope at that point.
Yeah.
And which is why this probably sold so easily, but why it was so smart to change it up.
Sure.
Because, you know, we really did see a bunch of these movies where it was, you know, let's pair these two classic old actors that nobody's hiring anymore together and put them into a young guy movie. And mm-hmm. that was just a thing for a couple of years. And this is right in that window.
Yeah.
But this really, the thing is, as you know, I made that comment earlier, why would you write a script for Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines? But the chemistry they have together,
undeniable.
It's absolutely undeniable. It's one of those great pair ups where you're just like, who thought that was a good idea, and why were they the only ones to think it? It's just wow. The fact that we didn't see more Billy Crystal Gregory Hines movies surprises me because they really did kind of, you know, just click.
Yeah, like to the point that you thought they had worked on something in the past, like maybe they came out of the same, you know, it almost feels like two guys that have worked on SNL together for a long time or something, you know, like where you're like, oh, well, they've gotten this timing down through years of, it's like, no, they came to set and they just nailed it.
Yeah. Now that said, there are some weird things about this movie. There are some flaws.
How dare you?
How dare I be? No, the biggest glaring flaw of this movie is not the Michael McDonald soundtrack.
No, because we'll get to that.
No, the issue that I have is that there's a lot of comedy in this movie that was clearly done after the fact. And, you know, it was probably two or three cuts into the movie that where the jokes are just ADR'd in, where they're not even on screen and they've just got Billy Crystal reading funny lines and cracking jokes, because whenever the pacing of this movie slows down, they cut to Billy Crystal saying something crazy.
Yeah.
And that becomes a crutch that gets a little tiring over the course of the movie, that once you start paying attention to that, you really do see, hey, we have no way to get out of this scene. Oh, let's have cut to a sunset and Billy Crystal saying something silly, you know, that just sounds fun. And some of those jokes work, and some of them not so much.
Yeah. Well, I have to believe that a lot of this dialogue, a lot of these moments were ad-libbed, or at least...
Only fools believe.
Only fools believe. No, because...
It's stuck in my head all goddamn. I know. You're right. Motherfucker.
You know, the wise man has the power to wish it away. No, but because the movie was originally written for older characters, and so much of the comedy between these two is the fact that they're kind of young smartasses, I have to believe that a lot of the comedy in this was, if not ad-libbed, then really just kind of fly by night. Like there's no way a lot of this humor was in that draft of the script.
Yeah, I would assume that they would get a rewrite, but you know, come to think of it, there are some weird moments in it that kind of make more sense when you know that. Like mm-hmm. the young punks, the young upstarts, we want you to train your new young replacement. It's like, it's John Grease.
We're the same age.
Younger.
Yeah.
Like, this is 1986 John Grease. He just got done playing Victor Laszlo in Real Genius 2 years before this, where he was playing the 30-something, you know, burnout graduate. You know, these guys aren't much younger than Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
And it's funny, too, when you watch that scene where they're playing basketball, you know, at the beginning of the movie, and you think to yourself, like, why is it inherently weird that Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines are out there playing basketball? Well, if they were in their 60s and doing that with that group of guys, then yeah, that would be a little bit more you know, off target. Like it would make a little less sense. But they still try to sell that as like, oh, you, what are they even doing on this court? And it's like, I don't know. They seem about the right age. But yeah, but there's a lot of humor like that that feels like them just riffing. And I think while I agree with you, there are some moments where that falls a little flat. I think a good 90% of it is just on point. Like the kind of stuff that you have trouble teaching when you try to teach people improv. Like just let it go. Like just let the whole thing flow, never break it, and it's so good.
Well, no, the
so
thing,
good.
The thing is my problem is particularly with the cutaways and the ADR jokes.
Mm.
Because when Hines and Crystal are in the same room,
yeah,
it's always magic.
Yeah.
Like there's just even the jokes that aren't funny on the page, they make funny.
Yeah.
Because they really do. Their back and forth is fantastic. And it's like the film that we're talking about next week, Freebie and the Bean, where these two guys are just at each other's throats in a way that only best friends can be.
Yeah.
And that anybody outside would think these two guys hate each other, and yet when you're let on the inside, you're like, oh, these two guys, this is how they relate. Like they're just an old married couple.
They sell and to that point, they sell it so well that it doesn't seem that weird to us when Billy Crystal just walks in while Gregory Hines is having sex and interrupts it.
Yeah.
Like it's awkward, but at the same time, like you never have
what
that feeling.
What are you doing? He's like, we've got Mendoza.
Mendoza.
Because this movie has its Mendoza.
It does. And it happens to be a Gonzalez,
in fact. Gonzalez, not Mendoza. Played wonderfully by a really annoyed Jimmy Smith.
So annoyed.
He's like, he's been the whole movie just annoyed by these guys. Like, he's just every time they show up, he's like, God damn it, these motherfuckers.
He's like a really toned down version of Jack Palance in Tango and Cash. He's just like, these two fucking cops keep ruining everything with my drug business.
Without the rats of the terrible maze.
Without the rats, without the maze, without the...
No, in fact, actually, if there's anything that can be said, Jimmy Smith is a much more dependable, reliable villain than
Jack Palance. Yeah, because he doesn't spend all of his money building mazes on top of bars.
His plot makes sense. He just wants to get it done, and he's actually kind of smart. He outsmarts the cops at a couple of points.
Yeah, and that's, I think, like the first big surprise of the movie, and I don't mean to ruin everything, but there's a moment in this movie that when you first watch it, so if you haven't watched it yet, maybe don't listen to this part. But
we told you in advance.
We told you. What the fuck, guys? We told you what we're going to be talking about. But there's a moment where... they've got Joe Pantoliano. We haven't even
Joey Pants.
Just for a second, let's talk about the cast outside of Crystal and Hines because
which is fantastic,
so fantastic. We'd mentioned Jimmy Smits as the villain. Dan Hedaya is the captain because it's an '80s movie. And then we talked about John Grease.
John Grease is the young upstart detective,
As well as Stephen Bauer, another young detective, and then. The obligatory snitch character that they completely shake down at the beginning of this movie in glorious fashion. I love the way they do this. I love the fact that, you know, Billy Crystal isn't the most, he doesn't cut the most imposing figure. So he finds really, really interesting, nerdy ways to shake people down. And my favorite thing is that they follow Joe Pantoliano up to his apartment. They find money in the briefcase. And then when he refuses to cooperate, Billy Crystal just walks outside to all the people playing basketball like, hey, guys, make sure you keep an eye on this place. He's got several $50,000 cash in a briefcase. So if you see any shady looking characters, make sure to report them because, again, he's got $50,000 and loose, untraceable bills. And it's just like, and then they're like, okay, well, I guess we'll go now. It's so perfect. Like, that's how you shake somebody down.
It's such a dick move. And that's the thing is these guys are dicks.
Yeah.
These guys are not, you know, there are protagonists, but this is the era back when, you know, this is the last days of bad cops being good cops.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you had a good heart, it didn't matter what terrible, awful things you did to the criminal element. It didn't matter how many people you put in jeopardy. It didn't matter, you know, what a cock knocker you were to these people, as long as you were doing it to the bad guys.
And as long as you were funny about it sometimes.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, you watch this and there's moments that you just kind of have to cringe. You're like, guys, come on. you guys are bad cops.
Yeah.
Like, you mean well, but Jesus, guys. Like, you, the line was way the fuck back there, and you guys are way the fuck over here.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's, it, and, but yeah, that's the start of it. And that's, and throughout the movie, they do a number of wholly illegal fucking things.
Yeah.
Every time they get pulled in by the captain and reamed out, they've got it coming. Which is one of the interesting, it's one of the interesting things about this movie. This movie really does kind of go against the tropes in that usually when you've got the cop being reamed, it's one of those things where the audience is like, no, the captain's wrong. They made the right call. And this is kind of like, no, they really did kind of fucking cross the line there. That was a little uncalled for, guys.
I love that Gregory Hines has this moment where Joe Pantoliano is trying to keep them out of his house. And he says, listen, here's the situation. I've got this gun. I'm going to take the gun out and shoot a lot of holes in the door. And if you happen to be standing against the door when I do it, then that's your problem.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm not sure that would fly necessarily. Yeah. But
the logic doesn't hold. But
yeah.
But yeah, but this is Joe Pantoliano in the very same era. Like, this is just right before, right after Goonies.
Yeah. This would have been, yeah, like, either the, wow, yeah, this would have been right at Goonies, yeah.
Era Pantoliano, and he's really great as the sniveling snitch.
Yeah.
Like, he's one of those character actors who's always great.
Yeah.
And this movie's just full of it. Like, this movie has so many great character actors just peppered throughout, like, even just in small walk-on roles.
Yeah.
But, yeah, all of those guys really deliver. Jimmy Smits plays the sleazy villain really well.
Yeah.
and even appropriately hams it up during the final climactic sequence. There's a great shootout with him where he gets caught without his pants.
Yeah.
And
he demands that Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines surrender their pants.
Yeah, so that he can walk out of the building without his cock hanging out. And the movie's just kind of crazy and fucked up and awesome in those ways.
Yeah. But it's weird, though, because those moments in any other movie would feel so silly as to be out of place. But for some reason, just I guess because of the situation that they've created.
Well, you know, it's I really feel that it has to do with the structure of this film, which, mm-hmm. again, we're going to talk about next week, because this film is not a plot intensive film. This is a film that is a comedy, and it's a buddy mm-hmm. comedy, and it's about watching these characters be put in these situations to generate the comedy, and the situations themselves really don't matter all that much in terms of narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, they luck into most of their things.
Right.
They luck out of most of their trouble. You know, they get caught dead to rights. Like, they have walked into a trap.
Yeah.
They're fucked. They should be dead. They should be floating in the river. And instead, what happens? Oh, there's two undercover DEA guys.
Yes.
There.
See, and this is why I think that while it's not plot intensive, structurally, it is really interesting because there is literally an entirely separate buddy cop movie unfolding in the periphery of this buddy cop movie.
Yes.
We didn't even know there was another buddy cop movie going on until it jumps up and saves our heroes.
Yes. And then we our heroes end up shitting on that buddy cop.
Yeah, they treat them like shit the entire time.
Movie.
I'm like.
Like, they saved their asses.
Yeah.
And they treat them like garbage and spend their whole time, like, trying to dick them over. So
yeah.
When they go and take credit for something, they're like, you assholes. And it's like, fuck you guys. You guys totally asked for it. You called these guys in and actually treat them like decent human beings, like fellow cops. Maybe they wouldn't have grabbed credit on their own to fuck over those two old assholes.
Totally old, quote unquote.
Their undercover work.
I mean, I'm just going to say this right now. I would watch a whole second movie about the characters that Grease and Stephen Bauer play.
Okay.
I would watch like, or you know what? Do the same movie, but from the other side. Do the exact same story from the other side. I would watch that too.
I think it's a different story. I think it's the you tell that story of the young up and comers
mm-hmm.
who just keep running into these asshole older super cops.
Yeah.
Who just keep shitting all over their day. And it's like we the first act of the movie is them setting up this big bust, and they're like, we got him. We've infiltrated. We fucking got him dead to rights. Tonight he makes the sale.
Yeah.
He's making the fucking sale. Who the fuck are these guys? holy fuck. Oh my God. What are these fucking super cops doing here? Holy shit. They save their bacon and then they spend the rest of the movie totally shit. Why are we not writing that movie right now? Why
I don't know.
Why are we pitching that movie right here? Because that is a movie I want to fucking watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the fact, and I can't imagine this was accidental. I just noticed this, but John Grease's character is named Detective Tony Montoya. And Stephen Bauer, you may remember, was in the movie Scarface with Tony Montana. I can't imagine that's an accident. Tony Montoya. Yeah, just a little too close. But I would totally watch a sequel that was Tony Montoya and Frank Sigliano, Stephen Bauer and John Grease's character from Running Scared, who get totally dicked over for no reason other than they're the rookies. And I think that's funny that at one point, Dan Hedaya makes Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines train them as their replacements because they're like, we're going to retire. We're done. Here's our 30-day notice. We'll solve this last case. So Dan Hedaya is like, okay, well, you got to train your replacements. And it's like, what? Wait, hold on. Why are they the replacements? It looks like they're long established. I feel like they're good.
They're like DEA guys.
Yeah, I'm like,
I don't know, but we're jumping over to this department.
Obviously, it's so well run.
Again, so well run. Has some weirdness to it that you just kind of ignore because it's a fucking comedy.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to be laughing.
And because the comedy is done well. And because there is charisma for days between Hines and Billy Crystal. Oh, yeah. So it kind of, yeah, you do kind of gloss over a few things that I literally hadn't thought of until just now. It's like, wait, why are they the replacements? Why does it, one planet doesn't work?
That's all stuff that it was hanging over me, you know, when I rewatched it recently. Because, you know, I saw it a couple times when it first came out. And then we watched it at one of your, you had a day where you watched a bunch of oddball cop movies.
Yep.
At your place. And that was some good stuff that day, too.
Yeah, I think we watched this. I think we watched Freebie and the Bean. And then I think we watched...
That was the night you had never seen Midnight Run.
Oh, that's right. I saw Midnight Run for the first time.
You don't need to follow this up with Midnight Run.
Yeah.
And we ended up watching Midnight Run.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, and then I watched it again recently before we recorded this episode. And it was just one of those where I was watching it and kind of picking apart the what made it work and what didn't work. And there were there's some oddball moments in it. But the thing is what you see is it really is a bunch of set pieces strung together for the sake of entertainment. That most cop movies are like, well, we're going to tell this great gritty cop story and we're going to buffer it out with comedy so that people are invested. And they're like, nobody gives a shit about the cop story. This is all about the characters.
Yeah.
And that's what really these two movies that we're talking about this week and next have in common is they're really simple stories about not so great cops that are really great characters.
And I think while that could be, like, you could interpret that as a slight against a movie, I think it's a great way to sidestep tropes and to sidestep a really conventional, you know...
Oh, absolutely.
Right by number stuff is focus on the characters.
Well, no, and that's why this movie works.
Yeah.
The thing is you don't... And that's one of the things about storytelling is you don't need to focus so much on the storytelling if you deepen your characters and we really care about what the characters are going through. If we don't have that deep of characters, i.e. something like, I don't know, maybe I Come in Peace.
What are you talking about?
Then you just have to start throwing all sorts of crazy plot elements in that make sometimes seemingly no sense whatsoever.
This may be the exact opposite of I Come in Peace.
It is the exact opposite of I Come in Peace.
It's so focused on characters that it doesn't throw anything strange at you.
The characters start out as best friends.
Yeah.
Unlike most buddy cop movies, you know, most buddy cop movies are like, you know, you need a partner for this case.
I work alone.
No, here, have this dog, have this African-American, have this, you know, whatever weird
Triceratops,
you know, here, have this talking macaque. It's like, you know, how could we possibly, you know, he's a suicidal loner. He's a family man 3 days from retirement. Let's watch what happens. And, you know, and you have Lethal Weapon, which is fucking awesome. But that became like the model. And it was just like, let's throw weird shit together. And here they're like, hey, what if we have two guys that are just already best friends and they're just always busting each other's balls because they like each other, not because they hate each other. And we just kind of want to see them get through it.
Yeah.
And that is compelling. And that works you through that whole thing. And that's what works you through Freebie and the Bean.
I'm just trying to figure out, I know this is off topic, why did we go through a spell where cops were paired with dogs? Like, you had K-9, you had Top Dog, Turner and Hooch.
Because it was the law of Hollywood.
The law of Hollywood? Well, it was, I haven't heard this law.
No. One of the laws of Hollywood is, and one of the laws of storytelling, if you want to make a character likable, give him a dog.
Give him a dog.
You give a villain a dog, and mm-hmm. you see him being gentle with the dog, you will see the humanity in that person. And that became, and that's a classic storytelling trope. But what ended up happening for a period of time mm-hmm. in Hollywood was producers would just say, can we put in a dog? Like, they would literally do that. Is there any way we get a dog? And so people started coming with scripts like, hey, I've got a movie. It's got Chuck Norris and a dog. And they're like, here's a box of money. Let's go make this movie.
Here's a box of money. Free to a good home.
Yeah. The dog movies did really well. I mean, you're a little too young to remember, but there was a period of time where it was not uncommon to go to the movie theater and there was a movie starring a dog and only a dog. You know?
Dude, and only a dog.
And only, it was the fucking...
No, I just imagine the posters starring a dog and only a fucking dog.
Yeah, they were called Benji.
Oh, that's right.
Benji movies.
Yeah, that's right.
There was a number of them. There were, fuck, in the 70s we had movies where people came back as fucking dogs. They would get killed and come back as a dog and solve their own death.
Ghost like, dog.
There are several of these fucking movies. They were like, hey, how could we merge... this movie where people are coming back as angels to solve their own death or to make up for what they did in life and put a dog in it. What if they come back as a dog? Like, this was literally waves of things. And eventually Hollywood got over the whole dog thing.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God, because there were a whole, you know, we should like do, I kind of want to do a dog month.
Damn it.
But I don't want to have to watch all of the dog movies.
Yeah.
Doggone
it.
We have to do it in August.
Oh, the dog days of summer.
Oh, fuck me. Boo. So hard. Yeah, no, we're not gonna
unless we can talk about drink
because we're not actually doing a dog month.
Spit that drink back into the glass. You do it now.
Oh wait, hold on. There is a Chuck Norris dog movie, dude.
There is a Chuck, and there's also Man's Best Friend. No, we're not doing it.
Also a Stephen King dog movie.
No, we're not doing it.
What about White Dog? We could totally cover White Dog.
Samuel Fuller's White Dog, really. Because that'll make everyone super comfortable. Jesus Christ. I can't.
But it's got Christy McNichol in it.
It's got Christy McNichol co-stars with racism. And that's not a fun movie to talk about. Hey, speaking of fun, I know we mentioned that,
now back to our previously scheduled
and now back to the show we were
which
doing,
which we diverged from entirely.
I can't believe we talked about dog movies and Chuck Norris and K-9 before we talked about the fucking soundtrack for this movie.
Let's talk about that soundtrack there, Michael McDonald fan 18.
I'm just saying. No matter how big a fan or how small a fan of Michael McDonald you may be, that song fucking kills.
Oh, this movie is, you know, like it's the yacht rock fucking American Graffiti. Like it's just
emphasis on the rock.
Yacht rock.
But it's so, I'm sorry, like this soundtrack is phenomenal, and it is led by Michael McDonald doing a song called Sweet Freedom that basically plays throughout the entirety of the Florida montage, and it's like this. It's like this herald. It's like the sound of what they're going to be, like their new life. It's the herald of their new life, and it's just really, yeah. Yacht rock is probably a good way to put it. It's very summery. It's very light. It's very, yeah. It's bouncy. It's so good, so good. I'm gonna play a little bit of it now because I never get tired of hearing it. So that is Sweet Freedom, Michael McDonald.
The rest of you are actually tired of hearing it.
No, you will never get tired of that song. You think you will, and then like an earworm, it'll be back tomorrow So good.
I won't deny that that Michael McDonald songs are earworms, but I, calling them good.
It's so, dude, I'm sorry. Like, it's very like, it's 80s and it's orchestration, but it doesn't have any of that like synth that inextricably ties it to the decade. So it's,
have you ever seen Matt Singer do Michael McDonald?
No, I have not.
Yeah, he does a killer Michael McDonald.
Cool, thanks. no, it's fine.
We've
it's fine.
Known for years, who comes down to Austin and does really like spot on killer Michael McDonald. Like the first time he belted that, I was like, "Holy fuck!
Is that Michael McDonald?
Where the fuck did this come from?" Like, it wasn't that like borderline Michael McDonald, borderline parody that you've got going. Like it's like legit. Like what the
fuck? I'm just saying this song. Speaking of legit, is legit. I'm sorry. This song is it's. It's like
really arguing about Michael McDonald.
I'm sorry. I think the song is great. I love this song. I have the soundtrack to this movie on vinyl. I fucking love this song. It's, you know, it's soulful. It's fresh. It's light at the same time.
You
I fucking
Michael
dig
McDonald
the hell
on vinyl.
I do. Fuck yeah, I do. Because I am a human being whose ears are attached to his heart. So Michael McDonald all the way. Shine, sweet freedom. Shine your light on me. That's all I'm going to say. Except it's not, because the show would be too short. So let's continue on. If you haven't watched the movie, you should go listen to the song. You should watch the music video, because it's like, it's the perfect movie music video where it's like all of a sudden Michael McDonald is somehow involved in the plot of this film.
Oh yeah.
You know?
No, it was a big music video at the time. It was one of those things that was very hard to get away from on MTV.
Well, the song was nominated for a Golden Globe. So I'm just going to throw that out there, because the Golden Globes mean everything.
Yeah, it was the 80s, and there was lots of coke going around. So these are things that don't surprise me.
What do you think made the Sweet Freedom shine, if not mountains and mountains of cocaine? I to me, those things go hand in hand. But yeah, no, I still like it, even without the cocaine in my present state of mind. Yeah, no, I still love that song. So check that out. We mentioned that this movie was originally written for Gene Hackman and Paul Newman. However, it didn't immediately then go to Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal. Evidently, the roles were first offered to Tom Selleck and John Travolta. Very different movie, I feel. Just like super... I don't know. I can't even wrap my head around that. I'm trying to.
Yeah, it's kind of a tough... It's kind of a tough pairing. It's,
yeah.
Like, what was the... It was very much like what we were talking about with Tango and Cash, where it's like, yeah, you've got one cop and then a cop that's slightly different.
But that other cop doesn't have a mustache, and that one does. They couldn't be any more different.
Yeah. And this was, now the thing is Travolta, this was in the era when Travolta had, you know, faded.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he'd had a couple of bombs. And,
oh, yeah.
And would be...
Staying alive, perfect. And then, like, seriously, he kind of disappears until Look Who's Talking in 89.
Oh, yeah. And that was, like, the bottom of the barrel. Where, yeah. You know, they were hits, but it was that, oh, this is that stage of my career.
God, he was just sitting around waiting for Tarantino to write a movie.
Oh,
just,
yeah.
Just like, man, if you look at everything he did between Blowout and Pulp Fiction, it's just like a gauntlet of shame.
Oh, yeah. No, that was the thing. When he came back, when Pulp Fiction happened, we were just like, holy fuck, where the fuck have you been, John Travolta? Holy shit. And he exploded again. He was back on the scene. And that was where Travolta got known for being the guy who resurrects careers.
No, well, Tarantino. That's
Tarantino.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, Tarantino. And that's, you know, at that point, every time Tarantino started casting movies, everyone in Hollywood started looking at whoever he was casting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at what happened to Robert Forster. Robert Forster had vanished until Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden.
Unfairly.
Yeah, no. And all of a sudden, he's back on the lists. And in fact, you talk to Forster, and he'll tell you just that. He's like, nobody called me anymore. Nobody took my calls. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, Tarantino calls up, and I'm like, yeah, I want to work. And all of a sudden, everybody wants me in their movies.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, yeah, but Travolta and Selleck, this, I don't think that would have worked
no.
at all.
No, it wouldn't have. And it's funny to me that, like, Selleck turned it down because he was still doing Magnum P.I., but Travolta's agent was just like, no, it's probably the wrong project for him. I'm like, really? Since when in this period?
Well, first of all, look at that list of movies and tell me that that agent knew what the fuck they were.
That's what I was going to say. Is like, at what point are you, as Travolta's agent in this time period, allowed to make any kind of estimation of what's right or wrong for your client?
Now, the thing is, Travolta paired with either Billy Crystal or Gregory Hines would have made for an interesting movie.
Perhaps. Yeah.
But not with Selleck. Because the thing is both of those, neither of those guys are really good at the zany comedy.
Yeah.
They're both good at kind of straight man comedy. But that's what's so great with what works about this combination is both neither Gregory Hines nor Billy Crystal are the straight man. They're both the zany one.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just both being zany at all times.
Yeah, that's true. This movie doesn't really have a straight man.
No. They're always goofing. And they each have their straight man moments where one of them is goofing, the other one is playing the straight man. It's like, this is serious, you know? I'm trying to lay this chick here. and it's like, no, but we got him. Oh, let's go,
I have a question about that scene.
Why would you have a police motorcycle?
In the apartment.
Okay, I was wondering if that's where you were going with that.
What? First, how did you, logistically, first of all, how did you even get it in there? And secondly, if that is your actual police bike, do you still use it? And if so, how do you get it out of there?
I'm of the opinion that that's really one of those things that you put together piece by piece so that you can just impress people that you put together a bike piece by piece and you walk into the apartment and there's a motorcycle. What's it there for? We turn on the lights and have them flash while I bone other guys' girlfriends.
Well, it's just weird because it's a big, like, empty studio apartment and then there's just a motorcycle. It's like the first stages of Tom Hanks's apartment from Big.
It's kind of like a set designer gone wrong.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, he's a cop, so obviously.
So what would you have in a cop's apartment?
A motorcycle.
A motorcycle.
No. That's what a cop rides. Like, you kind of understand what a cop is, and I appreciate that.
But no, it's so meta.
It's not
artistic.
It's not meta. It's just in the wrong place. Okay. Take it outside. Put it back on the street. And you're fired.
But they totally do it.
And meanwhile, they drive around in a cop car that's unmarked until a bunch of kids spray paint, "This is an unmarked cop car," on the cop car, which is hilarious to me because then they just drive around with it.
I love the solution, though. Like, they want the car to be invisible, and they're like, we want to be able to drive around and be invisible. And he's like, I know exactly what you want.
So
they paint it as a taxi.
So, yeah. So they go to the guy... Ace, who is very much like that weird character that Michael J. Pollard plays in Tango and Cash, where it's like, you're just the gadget guy for the police force? That's what you do? Okay.
Well, he's not really the gadget guy. He's the police mechanic. Like, he works on the cars. The fleet.
But they make a lot of jokes about him being Q. They make jokes about ejector seats and, like, missiles and whatever. And it's just, it's funny to me that the solution ends up being, no, just drive a different car. And actually... the actor who plays Ace, Larry Hankin, if you guys are fans of the show Friends, was Heckles on Friends, the weird neighbor from downstairs that always complained that they were being too loud. I see this guy turn up in all of these movies. He's another one of those great character actors. But yeah, it's so the solution becomes just drive around in a taxi cab.
Why don't you do a Friends podcast out of curiosity?
I've pitched one, actually. I'm putting it together. Look for the Kickstarter.
We'll call this episode the one where Brian talks about his Friends podcast.
The one where Brian talks about his Friends podcast. So, yeah, the one last thing I want to talk about with this movie is I think that for all of the comedy stuff and for all of the, being light on plot and so forth, the action sequence at the end of the film is actually pretty damn impressive.
Well, it's Peter Hines.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that can always be said about Peter Hines is even in his worst movies, the action set pieces are fucking amazing.
No doubt.
The Musketeer is not a good movie, but those action sequences are fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, and when he does nail it with something like Outland, it's just fucking pure tension.
Right.
So yeah, this is Peter Hines doing what Peter Hines does best. Like he's a phenomenal action director. His scripts are not always the greatest, which is the problem that he ran into. But his direction is usually spot on.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you start off with a brilliant script and Peter Hines directing it and then it ends up terrible. Usually it's some other element drags him down. But yeah, he directed the hell out of this final action sequence, and it's really great.
You know, you get the high rise element. So you got a little bit of the vertigo to disorient the audience. You still got the comedy. You've got, you know, as you said, Jimmy Smits is really losing his cool in the best way possible in terms of spectacle. And yeah, I mean, it's just like all the elements coming together perfectly to give this movie a great send off. And I guess, no, I mean, I'm not surprised in terms of it being a Himes film. I am surprised, though, in, you know, they work so hard on the comedy in this film and developing these two characters and the chemistry between them that you could understand if that priority shift would cause, you know, the action to kind of fall by the wayside. And throughout much of the movie, there is action, but it's, you know, it's fine. You know, it's there and it works. But it's that last sequence, I feel, that really makes you go, okay, no, this is impressive. And I think it's the perfect capper to the movie because it really does allow Hines and Crystal to spotlight exactly what they've been doing the whole movie that's worked so well, is that when even though they've been trying to sidestep danger throughout the whole movie, they're just accidentally in the shit all the time. And the way they handle that is superb. And the way that it comes out in that final sequence, I think, is probably the best and really does cement what they've been doing the whole movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know. If you haven't seen Running Scared, add it to your list immediately. You should have already watched it. We gave you homework at the beginning of the month. Damn it. Why aren't you watching it already? But highly, highly recommend this. This is, like I said, not only one of my favorite buddy cop movies, but just one of my favorite movies in general. I love this movie. I love the soundtrack. I love the chemistry between the two of them. Jimmy Smits is a great villain. I desperately want to see a sequel about the other two cops. Actually, funny enough, there was a sequel in the works called Still Running. There were different scripts written, but Crystal and Hines didn't think any of the scripts were strong enough to warrant a sequel and turn them all down. And that's really, it's kind of heartbreaking. I would love to see one more adventure with these two cops. And it, you know, unfortunately, obviously Gregory Hines left us. He's no longer on this planet. But if he had been, they could have still done this movie where they are actually now at retirement age, where they are now the cops old enough to retire. And then at the end of the movie, when they try to come back to like, people are just like, no, you can actually be retired this time. It's fine. That makes sense. We're okay with it.
What you do is you flip it.
Yeah.
What it is it comes time for their retirement and everybody's telling them to retire and they're like, no.
They refuse to go.
They get this crazy idea in their head. If they keep solving these big cases,
yeah,
there's no way that the city can let them go and retire because they'll be too valuable. And so they keep putting themselves in more and more danger, trying recklessly to solve as many cases as possible in order to stay relevant and stay on the force.
And they hate watches. People keep trying to give them watches and they're like, I'm not retiring. So the whole movie, they are unreasonably violent toward watches because they don't want to retire from the police force.
This man, keep an eye on this apartment because this man has a $50,000 gold watch.
He got it for retiring from the police force. Well, that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And this week, I got to do it. I know it's hack. Whatever. I got to go with it. Dunkin' Donuts is this week's junk food pairing. If you're like me and Billy Crystal in this movie, trying to pronounce the word croissant really makes you uncomfortable. Therefore, you skirt any attempt at healthy breakfast and instead grab yourself heaping handfuls of every cop's best friend, the Dunkin' Donut. Oh my God, so delicious. I don't know why you would ever bother with a croissant. I'm with you, Billy Crystal. I agree with you 100%.
You pronounce Krispy Kreme wrong.
Stop that. It was a box of Dunkin' Donuts. Had it been a box of Krispy Kreme, that's what we would have gone with. But for accuracy, which is what we always strive for on this podcast, accuracy and professionalism. I just heard myself say that out loud, and it's ridiculous.
You really should take that back.
I'm gonna take that back and put it back in the glass and just put it back on the table. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. I hope you'll be back next week to ride off into the sunset for Buddy Cop July with Freebie and the Bean. But for now, we'll remind you that you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also like the website on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, or follow us on Twitter @junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm. That's MassaWyrm. Or on Facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or at oneofus.net, my home away from home, where all the geekiest podcasts and blogs are for every taste imaginable. No matter what you're into, we have something for you. But for now, I'm gonna go ahead and sign off, reminding you to always be searching for the real thing, living like it's far away. Just leave all the madness in yesterday. You're holding the key when you believe it. Shine, sweet freedom.